I'm just going to say a couple of things about the sort of seminar title before we start, just a couple of minutes. So the seminar series, I don't know how many people came last term, but what we've sort of set out to do has tended to be sort of concerned with literature, with writing practices. One of the things we've wanted to do is to get writers to come and talk to us and to look at sort of how interculturality, relations and interactions between cultures are figured within sort of literary texts. But today we wanted to step back from that, and rather than engaging in dialogue then with a literary practitioner, we wanted to kind of think more broadly and theoretically about the notion of interculturality itself. So what kind of term is this? What sorts of theoretical models might we use to evoke the sorts of relationality that we see around us today as well as in literary works? So Mohamed Salah and I chose the notion of the intercultural for this series, I think, deliberately. We thought some of the alternatives maybe kind of raised their own problems and perhaps continue to demonstrate the need for a little bit more thinking about cultural interaction conceptually. So we could have talked about multicultural, for example, multiculturality. I think Peter, I don't know if he's going to be mentioning this later, I certainly he's written about the pitfalls of the notion of multiculturalism. For some, it maybe kind of ends up actually emphasising separations between groups, kind of living alongside one another, but not necessarily with a sense of kind of interaction. Maybe multiculturalism designates sort of many cultures, but they might still be conceived as kind of self-contained or sort of divided off from one another. As an alternative, the French have tended to talk about sort of integration or intégration. So that would be sort of working against that emphasis on difference to encourage instead maybe a reflection on sort of sharing and the creation of a kind of shared culture between different groups living together in the Republic. Clearly, this model is also deeply flawed, both because it proposes a kind of unworkable homogeneity and because it fails to address the real ghettoisation of some cultural groups in France. We could have chosen, however, to celebrate transculturality, so that would be a derivation of the term transculturation, which was originally invented by the Cuban Fernando Ortiz, who someone might be able to correct my pronunciation of his name, and that was to kind of describe the merging and recreation of cultures largely as a result of colonialism. I think the trans here is, on some level, helpful. It stresses movement, the bridging of gaps, cultural interaction. On the other hand, you might say that the noun transculturation also maybe implies a kind of completed process. I think it's certainly a helpful alternative to acculturation, which would be the acquisition of a kind of a new culture and therefore maybe the kind of rejection of a former culture. But it also maybe stresses a kind of transcendence, links between people or groups sort of over and above the context in which they live. The intercultural, though, seems important because it kind of maintains that sense of dialogue between specified contexts, a kind of movement between rather than any sort of dissolution, I suppose. Finally, there's the noun interculturality in today's seminar title, but if we put the noun there, it's certainly not to kind of think about a sort of a state or a condition. It's not at all a fixed set of relations, but a continued process of engagement, of exchange. And I know that Birgit and Peter have both, in different contexts, explored that kind of crucial notion of movement. So intercultural dialogue is always evolving. It keeps its participants moving as well. Anyway, so I set up the session today to think a little bit more then about how intercultural exchange puts people and communities in relation to each other, how languages and cultures interact, and what fundamental concepts of human communality and indeed subjectivity underpin all this. So is the model of the individual versus the collective still workable? How do we think about relationality without overstressing either sameness or difference? And then what role might literature play in thinking about cultural interaction? Okay, so the first speaker is Birgit Kaiser, who I'm delighted has come all the way from Utrecht. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Comparative Literature at Utrecht University, coordinator of Terra Critica, Interdisciplinary Network for Critical Humanities. She published a book in 2010 on Figures of Simplicity, Sensation and Thinking in Kleist and Melville, and also edited a volume on postcolonial issues in Deleuze, so maybe that might come into today's discussion. More recently, she co-edited a special issue of the journal Parallax on diffracted worlds, diffractive readings, onto epistemologies in the critical humanities. So I think maybe that notion of diffraction might be coming back later. Anyway, over to you, Birgit.
Thank you very much. I will stand, if you don't mind. No, thank you very much, Jane, for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here and be able to speak to you. I've distributed, I've asked Celine, she kindly offered to distribute a handout for me. So the handout you found on your seat is relating to this talk. And as you can see, I'm not giving a title of my talk, because I couldn't decide what I was going to call it. And I think if I had given you a title, it would have been something like Writing Singular Plural, Cixous, Nancy, and Derrida on Subjectivity, something along those lines. I will start by saying a few words about the prefix of interculturality that Jane was also just mentioning, to situate what I'm going to say about Cixous mainly, because that's going to be the main focus of my presentation. And if I do so, it is not to propose yet another prefix that we could use, inter, multi, trans, intra, but to try and say what I am after when thinking about interculturality. So I think it's not about, you know, finding the best time to describe what we're talking about, but the interesting thing about these prefixes is that we, when we think about how we call the things that we're thinking about, I think we are thinking about how we are thinking about things. And that's, to me, the most interesting aspect. I will take about 35 minutes, so bear with me. In her text Against, Between, a Manifesto of 2002, Leslie Adelson, a scholar of German studies, expresses her hesitations about the uses of between in theorizing cultural encounters, and especially for the analysis of literary writings considered as migrant literature. In that text, Adelson takes the work of the Turkish-German writer Emine Sebki Özdamar as her example. Adelson notes that when we speak of migrant literature, it is often in terms of literature between cultures, or of their authors as hybrid, designating their cultural identities with hyphenated terms such as Turkish-German, or Moroccan-Dutch, or Franco-Maghrebian, which is not even a national denomination, as Derrida has argued. We tend to imagine these hybrid beings as somehow torn between cultures or perpetually suspended on a, quote, imaginary bridge between two worlds, unquote, an image that Adelson deplores and one that we might say is structurally complemented by the demand for either integration into one of these worlds or nostalgia for the return to the other. Adelson argues that such an image of thought, however implicitly that may be, treats these two worlds as pre-existing and is ultimately immune to the changes that migration and mobility causes within collectives and to individuals or within individuals. It keeps, she writes, quote, discrete worlds apart as much as it pretends to bring them together, unquote. While it also forestalls the chance to picture migrants or intercultural writers, quote, actually crossing the bridge and landing somewhere new. So it is the implicit assumption of a static or given unit of culture on which such a between implicitly rests that Adelson finds problematic. Keeping Adelson's concern in mind, now my own question with my own work is how ideas of myself or subjectivity are formed if we do not start from pre-existing cultures into which or between which one is situated. If we theorized what we mean when we say interculturality as intra, for example, meaning on the inside, within, between layers of, while inter, the OED gives between, among, in the midst for inter. So if we theorized it as intra, on the inside, within, or between layers of, that may be one phrasing to alert us to the fact that we easily presume cultures to be there, and then one travels from one into the other, or one does not quite fit into one, or one falls in between, etc. Karen Barat has explored in her work on materiality and meaning this prefix of intra. She notes that intra-action rather than inter-action signifies, quote, the mutual constitution of entangled agencies, unquote. It emphasizes the activity on the inside or within a field of exchange and encounters, and the transformations and differentiations that result from it. Barat is concerned that interaction assumes, quote, that there are separate individual agencies that precede their interaction, and favors intra-action in order to recognize, quote, that distinct agencies do not precede, but rather emerge through intra-action. Now, how does, in such conditions, that is, in societies marked by bilingualism or plurilingualism, culturally layered, post-colonial, migratory, what are the links under those conditions of literary writing to the formation of subjectivity? How to imagine subjectivity on such linguistically, historically, socially multilayered terrains, otherwise than in the identitarian mode of a de souche, or the other option being hybrid, a sort of split between or emerging of two. I will start by briefly considering singularity, or rather the singular plural, as an aid to pursue these questions. First with recourse to Nancy's, but also to Derrida's thought on singularity, and then by looking at a selection of texts by Hélène Cixous, which I think offer a rich poetic performance of an intercultural, intracultural existence and the grafting of a singular plural voice. And my question is, which strategies of self-formation or narratives of subjectivity can we discern from these texts? And how do Cixous' texts perform or think through the formation of subjectivity under those conditions? In his text, Being Singular Plural, Jean-Luc Nancy writes, quote, the singular is primarily each one, and therefore also with and among others. The singular is plural. Quote. What Nancy's use of singularity foreground is the each and every one, and yet as such plural. That is, the singular is not for Nancy to be confused with the universal or the absolute as transcending all specificities, nor with the single or the individual as inaccessible, ultimately isolated, alterity. Even if it stresses the non-substitutable, that means the singular being cannot be replaced by another, it is singular, non-replaceable. Singularity in Nancy's sense is not a closed-off unit or individual in an atomistic sense of an individu, an indivisible smallest core unit. It is by definition always and only among others in the plural, and it exists only under the conditions of being with. If you're familiar with Nancy's work, that's the big revision sort of he makes of Heidegger's being there. Singularity as each and everyone, considering singularity as each and everyone, does venture to respect the other as untranslatable and really other, that is, inappropriable, not same, not like me, but other, whose untranslatability precisely demands that I translate. But Nancy is not concerned primarily with singularity in this quality of an irreplaceable other as removed and ultimately ununderstandable, unassimilable, but as singular plural, that is, profoundly relational, because in permanent coexistence with others and in ongoing translations of otherness, starting from the grounds of our material existence and the abundance of differences, living together in a profane community, that is, in a non-theologized, non-mythologized, immanent community. The traditional framework of a binary of self and other, which we tend to use to understand formations of individual and collective identities, is pluralized in this move. And it is rephrased as the uniquely textured selves, continuously in formation and translation. In Being Singular Plural, Nancy explains this pluralization as follows. That's the first quote in your handout. Not only are all people different, but they're also all different from one another. They do not differ from an archetype or a generality. The typical traits ethnic, cultural, social, generational, and so forth, whose particular patterns constitute another level of singularity, do not abolish singular differences. Instead, they bring them into relief. As for singular differences, they are not only individual, but infra-individual. It's never the case that I've met Pierre or Marie per se, but I've met him or her in such and such a form, such and such a state, such and such a mood, and so on. And early on in the book, Nancy notes, and that's the second quote in the handout, the singular plural constitutes the essence of being, the constitution that undoes or dislocates every single substantial essence of being itself. Being does not pre-exist the singular plural. To be more precise, being absolutely does not pre-exist. Nothing pre-exists. Only what exists exists. This proposition proposes nothing but the placement and disposition of existence. It is its plural singularity. At the opening of Being Singular Plural, Nancy explicitly notes that we have to develop practices and terminologies that envision a we and an I, which takes the coexistence of every and each body into account, especially in view of increasing heterogeneity and cultural diversity. He opens the book by referring to, it's an early 90s book, he refers to the Balkan war in Sarajevo. But I also think for our contemporary realities, if we only consider the increasing migration across the Mediterranean, for example, we are challenged to think through cultural identifications beyond national identities or cultural identities. And it seems to be a question of taking every single body into account. Otherwise, it would remain a question of hospitality, perhaps for a certain time, and then going back to some place where it came from, etc. Now, C ends the paragraph from which I have quoted with a footnote in which he refers to several theorists working in the tradition of what he calls thinking each one and the singular, and he mentions Agamben and Badiou, but prominently Derrida and Deleuze. And for the sake of time, and because of his greater intimacy with Cixous, I only want to briefly focus on Derrida and on what he remarks on singularity in his book Monolingualism of the Other, especially since the singular is articulated there in relation to the languages one speaks, which is also very much of importance to Cixous, which I'm going to come to in a second. At the very opening of Monolingualism of the Other, when Derrida mentions for the first time the paradox for which the book has become famous, namely, I only have one language, it is not mine, you may be familiar with that phrase, he goes on to unfold the sentence as follows. That's quote 3 on your handout. So he says, I only have one language, it is not mine. Or rather, and better still, I am monolingual. My monolingualism dwells, and I call it my dwelling. It feels like one to me, and I remain in it and inhabit it. It inhabits me. The monolingualism in which I draw my very breath is for me my element. Not a natural element, not the transparency of the ether, but an absolute habitat. It is impassable, indisputable. I would not be myself outside it. It constitutes me. Yet it will never be mine, this language, the only one that I am thus destined to speak. And truth to tell, it never was. The crucial point of Derrida's monolingualism of the other, which is an important addition he makes to monolingualism, it's not just monolingualism, it's monolingualism of the other. The crucial point of this for me is that it thinks through the paradox of an articulation of such a habitat as singular and intimately bound up with others. Derrida's monolingualism of the other addresses, focusing on one's relation to language, the paradox of living in a language that comes from and is addressed to the other and yet makes this language one's own, one's natural habitat, the natural habitat of this very body. He speaks of such a paradoxical structure in the book as, quote, alienation without alienation. But what simultaneously occurs as the flip side of Derrida's point of it's an alienation, which is so fundamental in a sense that it is without alienation. There was no prior me, and then I'm alienated. But it's the basis of everything that I am because my language comes from the other. I am always already alienated. But on that basis, on the flip side of this, we could call what is happening also an appropriation without appropriation of that language. One speaks the language of the other, never one's own, and yet one articulates oneself and becomes in this language, since one only has one tongue, literally. He calls this the, quote, interminable and indefinitely phantasmatic process of identification, which is precisely not identity. Identification, precisely not identity. The difference Derrida stresses here between identity and identification is an important one. Identification highlights process over any ready-made product or endpoint to be reached, and praxis over property. That's why he says, I don't own it, it's not mine. But I use it, and I become in it, and it is me. Both imply the formation of subjectivity as an ongoing subjectivity, as the articulation of myself in the language that I speak, the language that I inhabit and that inhabits me. Both imply the formation of subjectivity as an ongoing, partly corporeal, partly imaginary praxis in which a whole range of cultural and imaginary repertoires and phantasmatic impressions and scenes are activated. While affirming the inherent otherness and plurality in language, which precludes any simple monolingualism, in the sense of I only speak one pure language, while it precludes this from the start, Derrida affirms simultaneously that on that basis we are required to account for the fact that there are singular bodies expressing themselves in a uniquely inflected and layered tongue. We are monolingual of the other to the extent that each of us voices this very unexchangeable reconfiguration of the language of the other, or the languages of the other. And with this, I want to turn now to Hélène Cixous, because I think that's exactly what she performs in her writing. May I ask if anybody's familiar with Cixous' work? In her conversation with Mireille Caille-Groubert, published as Interviews in Rootprints, Memory and Life Writing, Cixous describes writing, which is, of course, for those of you not familiar with her work, it's one of the big terms of her poetic work and theoretical work, écriture féminine, feminine writing, being a term she coined. She describes writing, among other things, as an effort to draw out the further than myself that are grafting myself. Quote, I also write in order to go further, further than what I say, and this is not impossible. I can go further than myself because there is further than myself in myself, as there is in all beings. Traces of others, the voices of my others, we are full of voices. Throughout her oeuvre, which by now stretches across more than 60 titles of poetic fictions, drama, and essays, it is such further than myself that are dug up, ported, set into action, remembered, and intonated. What comes to pass in her writing, it comes to pass as her writing, which started with Le Prénom de Dieu in 67, and which has now come to its most recent title, Le Détournement de la Mort, in 2014. What comes to pass in this writing, it seems to me, is a tracing of these voices of her others. And in the process, and at the same time, and this is writing from 67 until today, publishing a book every year, it's an ongoing exercise, what comes to pass in this writing is a thick description, we might say, with Clifford Geertz, or a thick mapping of a narrative I. We can see this already as a feature of the corpus of the texts themselves. Each of her texts stands apart from the other and circles around a different, although often circles around different, although often recurring figures and scenes. But each is also subterraneously part of the others. Her texts make dense intratextual references across the entire corpus of text, and the narrative voice continues as a recognizably similar narrative voice across them. In his book on Cixous called HC for Life, that is to say, Derrida remarks in this vein that, quote, the whole work, some 50 books, Derrida saying this in 98, some 50 books back then, 60 now, the whole work, some 50 books, every one of them equally singular, is magnetized, held in highest, high tension vibration by the power of a magnetic subsoil at once actual and virtual, a bedrock that recharges every verbal unit with the memory and projection of all the others, unquote. This enables one to make Derrida write, quote, underwater excursions from one book to the other, quote, but it also requires, he says, that one would need to be aware at every moment of every quotation, of every word, unquote, in order not to miss the linkages and reverberation of these, quote, figures with 600 voices, unquote, that populate Cixous' texts, which he calls a braid of unalterable threads and lines, a weaving of voices. Now the same goes, I think, for the presentation of a myself that occurs in her text. If Cixous notes that there is further than myself in myself, as in all beings, traces of the voices of my others, of which Derrida says she has at least 600, and this is in reference to a book about the 600 letters from her father, it is this process of composition to which she refers, I think, a composition whose result is always in the making and never fully coincides with herself as an individual, as the core unit. It's the composition of a voice, a quasi-autobiographical project that Derrida calls, quote, the voice with the 600 voices that speaks of itself / herself. But Derrida in his book continues to ask, which is the one, masculine or feminine, of these 600 voices that weaves and braids all others in unique fashion? It is Nancy's notion of the singular plural that seems most helpful, I think, to respond to this question. Such a response would certainly not amount to finding out which one of those voices it is, finally, that integrates all others into one. And Derrida responds to his own question by saying, I do not know. And I think this is not a confession of ignorance, because he doesn't know, we have to find out which is the one voice that that organizes all others. But it is an assertion, I think, that a retracing of the 600 onto a dominant single one, which would then have to be either masculine or feminine, and on a meta level of all others, is not the point. Instead, it seems that what is at stake is how she composes and textures this voice from a multiplicity of other voices, a narrative crypto-autobiographical voice that is being tuned in the ongoing process of writing. Of course, Cixous has repeatedly stressed how much she detests autobiography. In the Book of Prometheus, she even claims it does not exist. But as Myron Hanrahan has argued, Cixous' aversion seems to, quote, relate not to the autobiographical enterprise per se, but to the desire to impose a form on its expression, unquote. To conform to the literary genre of autobiography, that seems to be the issue. To assume a somehow completed, unified subject outside the text who reflects on her life as if preceding and separate from the text. When Cixous says I, she insists in the Book of Prometheus, quote, this is never the subject of autobiography. I is the heroine of my fits of rage, my doubts, my passions. I lets itself go. Unquote. It is, and she wrote this earlier in Sortie, this is a 75 text, an evocation of, quote, my people, all those that I am. Unquote. And later in that text she says, it's a crystallization of my ultra subjectivities. I is this exuberant, gay, personal matter, masculine, feminine, or other, where I enchants, I agonizes me, a concert of personalizations called I. Such a pluralized mode of personalizations is rather a long way from the conception of a self constructed via or constituted via a self-other binary. There's too many voices in Cixous, in a sense, to fit into a binary of self-other. And the assumption of a lack. So the subject or ego in the tradition of Cartesian and Hegelian models of self-consciousness. And we could go into a completely different paper forever on how she argues with that idea of the subject in her best-known theoretical text, Sortie and the Love of the Medusa. But I wanted to rather go into some poetic texts. I think what she performs is even unlike those deconstructions of the big S subject that we have seen since at least Freud. In the conversation with Kai Goubert mentioned earlier, she explains that such an I, quote, is not I, of course, because it is I with the others, coming from the others, putting me in the others' place, giving me the others' eyes, E-Y-E-S, unquote. something that was called as early as the Laugh of the Medusa, quote, a process of becoming in which several histories intersect with one another. This I with the others emerges in the process of writing. It's not there and then she writes it down. It is a product of the process of writing. A writing that she qualifies in Sortie as, quote, working and being worked. A course that multiplies transformations by the thousands. Now with this in mind, how am I doing on time?
Okay, yeah, keep going.
Okay. With this in mind, I want to take a look at two of Cixous' most recent works of fiction. Abstract et bref chronique du temps, chapitre l'eau, that's Abstracts and Brief Chronicles of the Time, the chapter l'eau, l'os, 2013, as well as its companion book, published a year later, entitled Le détrônement de la mort, The Deposition of Death, subtitled The Notebook of Chapitre l'eau. And she mentions in the opening of the second one that it is le shadow book du chapitre l'eau, the shadow book of the other one, and as such perhaps also a key example of the subterranean relations between her texts that I mentioned earlier. Now, Chapitre l'eau, written 2012, published January 2013, is, if we stay with Derrida's phrasing, a weaving of voices on at least two levels. On the one hand, on the level of the narrative I, who, through and with the voices of the two main others in those texts, and that's Maman and Carlos, dwells on death and on the passing of time and on what that passing means for moi, the narrative I, how they inform and form a living me. And on the other hand, on the other level, the text is plurivocal on the level of poetic registers and intertexts that are used to construct this text. Like most of Cixous' writing, Chapitre l'eau is heavily intertextual. In this case, the most evident references are to Shakespeare, whose Hamlet provides the book's title. It's a quote from the Abstracts and Brief Chronicles of the Time, as a quote from Hamlet. And Blake, whose Song of Loss provides the book's subtitle, along with references to Proust, Ovid, Montaigne, Dante, Balzac, Donne, Emily Bronte, and others. In addition, and perhaps more interesting for us, the loss of the title is no solo reference to Blake's loss, who in his mythology is the eternal prophet, but the syllable, or the word, could be both, is itself an echo chamber of many languages. To only mention the most explicit layers that the text deploys, there is at the beginning the German los. I mean, all of this is spelled L-O-S. Los, when at the opening of Chapitre l'eau, the narrator's aging mother asks in German, in this French text, was ist los? When to her surprise, and contrary to her expectations, she did not die that night. Translated in the text as, que se passe-t-il? What is happening? So los as in passing, passing of time, and happenstance. Later also signaled as the German noun das Los, which is the lot, and the adjective los, which means detached or loose. Then there is the English loss, which in this case would be spelled with two S, and which the text plays on when it plays on Blake's poem by making it the Book of Loss, but also when evoking Shakespeare in All is Lost, thematizing the loss of a loved one who has passed, and this refers both to Maman, who is aging and dying, and to the other reference to Carlos, which I'll come in a minute, the loss of a loved one who passed, and asking how these voices remain to the living I. And most importantly, perhaps, loss is also the second syllable of the Spanish first name, Carlos, to whom both texts, Chapitre l'eau and Le détrônement de la mort, are eulogies, songs like Blake's Song of Loss. It is the news of Carlos' death that provokes the writing of both texts, or of that text, and then the second one is a revisiting of the writing process of the first one. And although a last name is never mentioned, the reader can gather that the C, or Carlos, or Loss in the text is moreover a reference to Carlos Fuentes. From the date of C's passing that is mentioned, 15 May, reminiscences of a meeting with Carlos and the Carpentiers in Paris, November 68, references to Mexico City and to Carlos' novels on the narrator's shelves, and later in Le Détournement de la Mort, then the overt reference to a box of letters kept in Caja 135 in the Princeton archive, which is indicating an exchange of letters between Cixous and Carlos Fuentes from 1969 to 74, which is indeed archived in the Carlos Fuentes and Latin American Literary Archives at Princeton University. Cixous summons us to unfold the text's dense linguistic material, prominently via the syllable los, in these different directions, in keeping with her practice of exploiting the homophonic and musical qualities of language. So we would have to hear in the written text at least four different vocal intonations. Lo, the French, los, for English, los, for Spanish, and los, for German. This is one exemplary instance, I think a particularly nice one, in which, quote, writing and voice are entwined and interwoven, unquote. This is how Cixous phrases her project and her understanding of writing in Sortie. An interweaving of voice and writing, that is, you could say, an emergence of voice via writing, quite an oxymoronic written voice, that is certainly not the voice of a metaphysics of presence, so a self-present voice that would precede writing. Of which writing would then be the secondary representation. On the grounds and within the material of such textual vocal layeredness, such semantic and plurilingual echoes moving in French, this is a French text, moving in French through German, through English, through Spanish, and back again, we can return then to the other level that I mentioned earlier on which the text perform a weaving of voices, the level of the narrative eye, without losing sight of these media materials in which the eye is orchestrated. And perhaps to stress that point and not lose sight of the materiality and mediality of the language in which this eye comes to us, we can perhaps consider yet another variation of the syllable los, its function in Spanish as definite article masculine plural, as for example in Los Hijos, the children, coincidentally also the title of the first chapter in the Détournement de la mort called Les Enfants. The plural that is encrypted here in the affectionate abbreviation of a lover's first name, because this, I haven't mentioned it, but certainly this is a love affair Cixous has with Carlos Fuentes and it's love letters that are exchanged. The plural that is encrypted here in the affectionate abbreviation of a lover's first name, Los, is important, especially when we consider Cixous' concern for I as I with the others. At the beginning of Le Détournement de la Mort, after three pages of commentary on the genesis of this shadow book, how she came to write this book, which is a standard opening for Cixous, how did I come to write this book? The first chapter is entitled, as I said, Les Enfants. The narrator begins by recalling a scene, quote, during the summer of 2012 when I speak of Carlos with the children. Contrary to what it seems, namely that they are, quote, three individuals. In reality, we are seven beings, of whom three are embodied actors in the summer of 2014, my daughter, my son, myself, and four tenacious, radiant subjects in top form, Carlos, my son, my daughter, and me in 69, unquote. What seemed to be three sitting in the garden in 2012 and still in the flesh in 2014 are, en vérité, three plus four. These latter being in and from 69, but still in top form, she says, en plein fort, which we could also translate, I think, as alive and kicking. This bizarre constellation portrayed here, which only covers the time span, she says, between the year Los, which is 68, I guess, and the year 14, would have to be multiplied by the thousands, as the narrator notes a page later in a direct address to the reader, which is, reader, multiply these notes by 15,000. That's the music of my day. In a similar vein, in Chapitre Lo, the narrator remembered Carlos multiplied. The passage opens, this particular passage, and it's the fourth quote in your handout, opens at the eve of his birthday. Presumably this is 1968, the year of their encounter and Carlos Fuentes' 40th birthday. The passage begins with the observation, "I am 40," English, which is English in the original, which could indicate not only that the I is 40 years old, but also that the I is 40 in number. "I am 40." That shows it, he is visible. He is ultimately not discontent with the interior image. He is with his interior image. He is 40 just by himself. 40 actors, inventors, thieves or aviators, flyers. With such a gifted company of players, he could reasonably wish to create the human comedy of the Occidents and the Orients. Each of the 40 can play 3 or 4 roles average. 40 times 40 characters, this is his range. At that moment, his life, his appearances, loves, all multipliable by 40, are aptly directed toward by his me. Where the opening constellation of Les Enfants in Le Détournement de la Mort presented a scene of several, so there's 3 in the garden, but in reality there's 7, which were each multi-layered diachronically over time between 2014 and 69. The narrator of Chapitre Loup here zooms in on one of those several and proliferates the different others that are concealed in or inform this one, synchronically at this moment. Therefore, we could, by implication, fold this synchronic multi-layeredness of one back onto the diachronic thickness of the scene in the chapter Les Enfants, and we would indeed, as the narrator had urged us, multiply these notes by 15,000. Adding then on top of that all that is on top of everything that is included in these 40, quote, "the lives not lived, the lives that I have neglected, the years that I have left locked up in the neighboring street, and that had all the reason to believe themselves forgotten." Thus, as if the multiplication by 40 had not been enough, the traces and inscriptions are not only marking an absence of what once was and is no longer, and also not only of that which is present otherwise than fully present. She calls these 4 that are sort of hovering above the 3 sitting in the garden, archi-present, or présentement, otherwise present. They're not absent, but they're also not present, they're otherwise present. But these traces on inscriptions would also comprise what was never actualized as a viable path, the path not taken, the book not written. All of this complicates and multiplies the registers in which any I can be thought. In H.C. For Life, Derrida remembers that Cixous had read with astonishment back in school Rimbaud's I is another. And he says, "She has never ceased to put this proposition back to work on all sides." So we could say that her written performance is not that of "je est un autre," I is another, but of, as she says, "j'ai été d'autre," I was of the others. Now surely, displacement and exclusion are two of the most fundamental elements of Cixous' experience. Growing up as a French-speaking Jewish girl in colonialized, partly Vichy-governed Algeria, and this informs her writing on the most profound level. She notes at the opening of My Algérians, which is a text that reflects on her relation to Algeria, quote, "my way of thinking was born with the thought that I could have been born elsewhere." What it produces, however, it seems to me, is less a split subject or a psychic division, perhaps on the model of Lacanian psychoanalysis or Hegelian self-consciousness, but it seems to me the affirmation of contingency and being singular plural. The sentence in My Algérians that I just quoted continues, so she says, "my thinking was born with the thought that I could have been born elsewhere. In one of the 20 countries where the living fragment of my maternal family had landed after it blew up on the Nazi minefield." So from this potential pluralization, she could have been in 20, emerged a written, textured, woven articulation in the making from book to book and back again. So it seems to me that what Cixous performs are the processes of tracing out a singular plural voice under the predicament that it cannot be traced back or anchored in authorial intention, a point of origin or stable identity. It's not the search for the real voice or the search for my authentic voice, but it's the production of my voice on the basis of many. It is rather the incessant work, it seems, on phrasing this body, which we would, might also pluralize as these bodies, which she, in Chapitolo she says, well, who am I today, looking back at the pictures from then, this is not the same me, I am that, but I'm also not that. So a work on phrasing these bodies, these histories, with these others, as more, all morphing over time, singularly diffracted at every moment anew. Cixous' writing is monolingual only in Derrida's sense. It is diffracting a multiplicity of voices into a habitat, or weaving a multiplicity of voices into a habitat, a plural singular composition in, as Derrida says, an interminable and indefinitely phantasmatic process. Such a performance qua writing might allow us to reconsider identification as an ongoing material, semiotic, and spectral process, whereby one can nevertheless learn to be, as she notes in interviews, how learn to be gaining earth, fabricating a ground. It may be that these politics of articulations, a term from Nancy, are most evident in transnationally or interculturally sensitized poetics. So writers and poets will think about this position of articulation in a language that may not be naturally their own. It may be that these that we find this most evidently in poetics that are sensitized in this way and produced in the interstices of cultural linguistic encounters, and that it is here that we are able to best learn new choreographies of singular plural modes of existence. But as modes of existence, they would seem to be exemplary, perhaps, of a wider structure of intra-cultural living. Thank you.
Thanks, Birgit, for a really rich and informative paper. I think that's going to stimulate lots of questions. But I think what we're going to do is move on and have the other two papers, and then we'll have a quick pause for a drink, and we'll come back and discuss and have questions a little bit later. So, Erica, do you want to come up? Okay, if you're right for time. Okay, Peter is coming up next. are you going to stand? Or do
I,
you
I need to push all
okay.
these buttons, yeah.
So. Okay, maybe Sunny can help with the buttons. So, Peter MacDonald is probably known to some of you, at least, here. He's Professor of English and Related Literatures then here at Oxford and Fellow of St. Hugh's College. His most recent book is The Literature Police, Apartheid Censorship and Its Cultural Consequences, published by OUP in 2009. He's also published on British Literary Culture and Publishing Practice, 1880 to 1914, published by Cambridge in 97. More broadly, he's interested in the socio-political space of literary production, literature and the law since 1800, literary institutions and questions of the book, and then ideas of the intercultural, and I think that's what he's going to be talking about today. So I'm going to move out of the way of the screen so I don't get people's vision.
Good to be here. I thought this is a. I'm now actually after Vivian's talk, wishing I had a scrupulously produced text in front of me, but this is a slightly more free-reading contribution. And it stems, I suppose, from one thing fundamentally, that is that, so I have written on and find incredibly useful Nancy, in particular, his exchange, or the exchange that was thrust on him with Maurice Blanchot to do with the Inoperative Community book, in terms of thinking about notions of the intercultural, and in particular, getting away from thinking about it in terms of nouns. So I have that is in the background. What interests me most, however, are the questions, and I noticed that this series was called Intercultural Literary Practice. that also interested me, except that what I'm constantly interested in ferreting out are varieties of intercultural literary experience in all its forms. And I am using that term, experience, in a loaded way, which is certainly linked to conceptions that Blanchot has of literary experience. The frame that I thought I would give to this is the following. And I'll maybe just read this out. This is a statement from 1995 by Hillis Miller in an otherwise fascinating essay called The University of Dissensus. It's responding to Bill Reddings' extraordinary reflections on the university in ruins that came out in the 1990s. But there's a whole lot of things about his language here that I want to just sort of pause on for a moment in order to then frame some examples and things that I'd like to just add to the contributive discussions that we can have. So this is what he says. The new technology, so he has in mind, he's particularly thinking about, it's 1995, he's thinking about the advent primarily of the internet, and it is in 1995, it is still a baffling, new, uncertain phenomenon. In many ways, it's now a little bit more habituated, but there's still, I think, in terms of its transformation of public space, it's still something that we're catching up with. Anyway, this is what he says there. The new technologies bring the uncanny or unheimlich other into the privacy of the home. They menace traditional ideas of the self as properly living, rooted in one dear particular culture-bound place. Participating in a single national culture and firmly protected from any alien otherness. They, again, these new technologies, are threatening also to traditional ideas of political action as based in a single topographical location, a given nation state with its firm boundaries and its ethnic and cultural unity. Then he says, Jacques Derrida calls this set of traditional assumptions the ontopolitologique. There's a little quotation from a seminar that Derrida gives, on which he then says, one reaction to this uprooting, dislocation, and blurring of borders discussed by Derrida in this seminar is the violent return to nationalisms, to ethnic purities, to fanatical militarized religions. And then Miller adds, another very different reaction, it may be, is the rapid switch in university humanities departments beginning in around 1980 from literary study organized primarily around the separate study of national literatures to cultural studies. Okay, so I want to keep all of that in the back of your mind as I go on to think about some of the examples, and particularly what I want to raise. I mean, there's so many things you can say about this. I'm above on the bathos of the final sentence, which is kind of, he tries to get away with it with the it may be. It seems to me an extraordinary conjunction to link fanatical militarized religions with the rise of cultural studies. So, I mean, there's an element of this discourse that I want to use as a starting point. There's also, one of the things that's interesting, just in terms of the academic register that he's adopting, it's not quite clear where he's talking in parody and where he's talking straight. He does that quite frequently. On the whole, Hillis Miller is a kind of a straight talker, but occasionally, exactly what the implication of the menace, they menace traditional ideas of the self as properly living, rooted in, and then one dear particular cultural place. So there's also, there's just a conception that the new technologies are only construed of as a menace. But then it's also, there's a sense in which he's distancing himself from anybody who might think that the self is rooted in one. So there's those sorts of equivocations. The questions that we've already touched on that certainly have been interesting me for the last decade or so are some of the ways in which he construes the notion of a national culture in its relation to self and in terms of political action, I think are equally relevant to the ways in which multiculturalism has been set up in the way that both of you have already mentioned, and I would add, in fact, many forms of interculturalism. So in fact, I again don't think that any of those nouns or isms actually help us really get away from the fundamental, you know, if you want to put it, ontopolitico-logique of you can see that this is coming from, it's, and I think it's a case with Nancy and Blanchot as well, very much coming from a European nationalist history is what they're doing. And then that gets replicated in versions of multiculturalism and I think in versions of interculturalism. And I don't think these are simply theoretical problems. The angle at which I'm coming at these things at the moment, because of a project I'm working on, is to do with thinking within UNESCO since the 1990s, where a notion of the intercultural is developed within UNESCO, which has also been developed at the level of European policy in the last decade. So Europe now self-consciously moves away, the Commission and its educational policies are moving away from notions of the multicultural, but they've substituted it with this term, the intercultural, in one way or another. I think it still has those ontopolitico-logique problems at those institutional levels. And this affects how money gets channeled and what projects get sponsored and how educational debates are conducted, both at the levels of UNESCO and European debates about these issues as well. Okay, the key thing I want to add to the discussion today is I think that all of this can happen, and when we are talking about these sorts of things, it's itself a problem. Even the mode of discourse of theory itself, but also of the particular forms of theorization that we're engaging with, everything can start to happen at a rather safe distance. And it's a safe distance from us. And so I know there are some people in this room who may have seen some of the examples that I'm about, for which I beg apologies, and ask you please to keep quiet. But here's a few. The key thing I want to have in the back of your mind is, with these examples that I'll bring through, is I think with a few of these, going all the way from the first one I'm going to give you now, I don't think any of us would have any difficulty seeing these as versions. Perhaps I'll say something about the ways in which they might be variously different, but as versions of precisely what Birgitte has just been talking about in relation to Sisu, as versions of a poetics, if you like, of the intercultural. I've deliberately left all of them unascribed, but I will mention that as I go along. So what I really want everybody to do is, in your various singular, plural ways, is to actually try to register what's happening in your head as you look at these things. That's what I partly mean by literary experience. So that's the first example. Excluding those who've seen this before, would anybody like to hazard a guess as to what it is that you're looking at, or indeed read it? No one. You can read it? What was the initial impression for most people, did you say?
I didn't see it straight away, for sure. But then increasingly I start to spot English letters that I recognise.
Okay. What did you initially see? What did you feel you saw straight away?
I thought I was seeing maybe Japanese or Chinese script.
Mm-hmm. Asian script. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that would be for all sorts of reasons to do with the aesthetics of the presentation,
yeah,
and so on and so forth. Yeah. I mean, I've had a particular few moments in museums with this artist, which I'll never be able to forget, where I've been standing in front of one of these things and reading it out loud to my kids, and a group of Chinese kind of university students were around behind me, and they were saying, how can you read that? We can't read that. Is this some ancient script that we don't know and you know? So this is a piece by, as you might pick up there, by the wonderful, I recommend to everybody, sorry, this is largely a sales pitch for a number of people that we should all look at, kind of verbo-visual Chinese artist called Xu Bing. There's Xu Bing, and it is called Nursery Rhymes 5. As I'm sure, has somebody worked it out?
Jack and Jill.
Yeah. So Jack and Jill going lines vertically down. Jack and Jill went up the hill, fetch a pail of water. Okay, this is a gimmick. It's a gimmick artwork. He does much more serious things along these lines, but it is precisely actually that moment, that cognitive affective moment that I'm partially trying to capture in terms of that notion of experience, where it is precisely your frames of reference, you know, what we bring to the way we see what is in front of us that is being addressed by, in all these ways that we're talking about today. And it's that moment of I don't know what I'm looking at, and then some transition is to, oh, I can read what's there that I want to hang on to. I think, again, this is another example of a very self-conscious kind of intercultural, if you like, at the level of now inscription and so on, poetics. I won't talk about this one for too long, except that when we get to these sorts of examples, quite often now you can get parallel texts where that notion, again, of a tension between a certain form of script and another form of script, one that you may be able to read and one that you cannot. I can say, I think, with absolute confidence that no one in this room can read the script at the top. Is that right? Or would you identify the language? Because there's hardly anyone left in the world who can do that. Maharashtri Prakrit. So it's one of the. It was an elite ancient language of South Asia, rivaling Sanskrit, but it was more popular in its orientation than Sanskrit. It wasn't Brahmanical. With a translation by the contemporary Indian poet Arvind Krishna Merotra. That's, again, I just want, because I've got another example coming up, I don't want to dwell too much on it, but that parallel text putting, again, the Latin script, not simply the English language, in conjunction with others, I think, in all sorts of ways. There are many writers who are doing that in various ways. The thing that I wanted to talk a little bit more about is this one, which is, again, by the same contemporary Indian poet, Arvind Malhotra. And it comes from his 2011 collection called Songs of Kabir, in which it is his translations of the medieval Bhakti poet, probably the most famous Indian medieval Bhakti poet, Kabir, Kabir is a signature, a name. There was a weaver called Kabir. But the Kabir corpus has now become a sprawling, endless, reinvented corpus of works where saying exactly what is the original Kabir's and what isn't is almost impossible. It's extremely popular even today in India, performed in the streets, sung. This is not printed. Kabir never wrote anything down. It was oral performance. It was recorded by others, and it continues to have an oral life where it is elastic and moved around. The thing that interests me most, and here might be most relevant, why I'm certainly interested in this poet and what he does, is that, yes, there's all sorts of ways in which you look at this collection. It was published, as I said, in 2011 by NYRB, New York Review Books Classics, is that he's on every page, just about every page, constantly giving you an experience that never allows you to settle into one world. simply by the use of epigraphs, for example, with, of course, the famous Roman general in the one, and the maybe slightly less Bhartihari philosopher and poet, Sanskrit poet, in the other, using those quotations, but he also uses quotations from Leadbelly, from Bob Dylan and others. There's a constant wanting to play with those things, which are also constantly playing with time frames. It's not simply cultural provenance and those sort of things, but with time frames and how you might situate those time frames. But in terms of the things that we were talking about, and certainly what Brigitte has been talking about, one of the things that fascinates me most about this project, and here we could talk at length, and I won't, but is that it is the other juxtaposition, one of the other key juxtapositions is going on with the English language, and this question of an English language that is not mine, that is being produced. And one of the key things here is, as you might, if I just read a bit of it, friend, you had one life and you blew it. From sticky spunk to human shape, you spent 10 months in your mother's womb, blocked off from the world into which you fell the minute you were born. A child once, you're an old man now. What has happened has happened. Crying won't help when death already has you by the balls. It's counting your breaths, waiting. This world, says Kabir, is a gambling den. You can't be too careful. It's a very self-conscious part of Arvind Merotra's idiom that it is a voice that is full of Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti. So what we've got here, and he's written, there's a superb essay by him, which I can give you the reference for, called The Emperor Has No Clothes, from 1980s, came in two parts in 1980. Where he's involved in a furious, as they are in India, furious debate about poetics with a rival poet from the 1970s, and where he's making it absolutely clear that what is going on for us, can inform us going on, is an anti-indigenizing, deracinating move. So if you put it, if you like, in the debates within post-colonial studies, and Derrida's Modernism and the other is a good way of kind of breaking out of that as well, because he's also partly putting that in question in the early 90s, is that, you know, if you look at the post-colonial debates, if you know the African tradition, for instance, the tension between, say, Chuna, Achebe, and Ngugi wa Thiong'o, but there's many other ways in which you can replicate this, where in the face of a colonial imported, imposed foreign language, English, French, whatever it might be, in the face of that challenge, for the likes of Achebe and Ngugi, there are only sort of two alternatives. One is you either indigenize English, you Africanize it, you Indianize it, you English it, you do whatever, or you abandon it altogether and you go back into, you dig deep into the, what Merotra calls the deep coal seams of the mother tongue. So you go back and you write in Kikuyu or whatever. I think that debate has, in some ways, it's understandable where it came from, and it maybe has run its course, but I'm fascinated by the fact that there was a whole group of 1960s of initially Bombay-based Indian poets who were thinking along completely different lines, neither indigenizing nor returning in some way to the mother tongue, but doing something else with English and creating this Americanized idiom. Another poet who does this is Arun Kolhatkar, but there are many, many, many examples from that period. So that's just one issue of again, precisely that relationship to the language, to English language. But we could. There's a lot more to be said about this. I mean, for instance, I won't, but there's a whole lot to be said about translation, which if you want to, we can come back to at the end, exactly because he is translating this from Hindi. But he plays fast and loose with translation as much as he plays fast and loose with history, as much as he plays fast and loose with the idiom of the English language, the idioms of the English language. Another perhaps more familiar example next, but one that is certainly it's central to the project I'm currently working on, is this. When you think of Sisu, when you think of various others, I think this is Derrida spent an enormous amount of time in the 1950s reading this text, and he's written brilliantly about it. But so this is just two, let's call them sentences, from Finnegan's work. As another example of a kind of intercultural literary experience, and one of the things that I was thinking of, particularly when Vigid was talking about Hélène Cixous, and I think where Finnegan's way becomes fascinating, because the amount that I've read of Cixous is not enough, but she is largely preoccupied with European languages. I think that's true. Joyce, in his experimentations in Finnegan's Wake, until about 1930, was also largely preoccupied with European languages. Then, in the early 1930s, he suddenly starts to layer on a whole series of non-European languages into what he was doing, particularly in relation to India and in relation to Africa. And this is one of those late editions. In fact, it's very late. It's 1938. It's from the, for those of you who know this mad text, it's from the ALP episode. It's the river episode. So you've got those two river names. One is a famous river in Holland. The other one is a less famous river in Nigeria, Olga and Maas. But the magic Wavis has Elfin and Onmeshes, and Simba the Slayer of the Zorga is slew. He's playing English and Kiswahili. So again, we can dwell on this for hours, but just one example. The magic waves. Maybe we can hear that in English again. Beckett got it right in the 19, obviously under Joyce's advice. You've got to listen to this and see it at the same time. You can hear it in one way and see it in another. You hear it clearly as magic waves, but it looks odd in Africa, and that is partly because it's got the words, the Kiswahili word for water, maji, is buried into magic, and the Kiswahili word for net, wavu, is in Wavus. But it goes on. Elfu is 1,000. As soon as you've got Elfu, you've registered and picked up that. Elfu Nanon, Simba the Slayer, one of the great bird texts going back to 40 themes, 40, 40, 40, Arabian Nights. Perhaps if Finnegan's Wake has any kind of odyssey behind it, like Ulysses does, it's probably the Arabian Nights. It's full of references to it. But Simba the Slayer is, of course, Simba is also Kiswahili for lion. Simba the Slayer, Simba the Sailor, but also Shiva the Slayer. But that kind of interculturality, which, again, I don't want to dwell on, I think it's vital for us to try to get a sense of what that experience is all about, what Joyce is doing with trying to create that experience in Europe of the 1920s and 30s of that 17-year-long project that he was involved in. I think trying to get at that is vital. Okay, I think with all of these examples, we would have no difficulty recognizing the intercultural poetics going on here. The final point I want to make is that that's all fine, that's very interesting. I hope I'm going to write an interesting book about a lot of these things. But what really interests me is why it is that we don't see this in those terms. That's what really interests me. Could I ask what most of you are doing at this point? Are you reading it? But are you reading the content or scanning the content in some way?
Looking at that interesting photo of Harper Lee.
Yeah, okay, right. Yeah. In one way or another, scanning the content. Okay. The thing that interests me and the whole business of, in a sense, again, what lies behind, I think it's partly what lies behind some of the things that were preoccupying Joyce, and what lies behind the problem I have with the way that interculturalism has been set up at the level of UNESCO and Europe, is that it is, again, precisely saying that what we want to do is we want to have educational policies that enable people of one culture to interact with another. My own feeling is the mistake with that, which is partly conceptual, partly policy, is that you have to first start with recognizing the interculturality that's already there. And here's just two very quick examples which have to do with particular obsessions of mine, so I won't dwell on them for too long. But here's one. The letter W. Very familiar to us all, with the Latin script. Of course, for some of you paleographers and know some of the history of writing, will know that the Latin alphabet had no such thing, that it made no distinction between U and V either. So we have the strange letter among the 26. It's actually more than that because of capital letters and various other things. But in the English alphabet, we have this thing, odd letter called double U. That in itself is a fairly new import, double U, into English. I mean, if you look at these things historically, which is again, I think, where it all begins, is the fact that in Old English and medieval manuscripts, the more conventional usage until 1100 was to use the old runic symbol, wyn, on the left. So, for instance, the word writing, until about 1100, would have been written wyn, r. So, of course, Old English was written in, you know, absorbed into the Latin alphabet in 700. So there's about 500 years of wyn being used. Then you have the Norman conquest and various other things. And W comes in. Another, perhaps less obvious, so it's the movement of these letters that is again showing that there's this ordinary bit of newspaper discourse that is around us is already deeply intercultural in all sorts of ways. The other, maybe less obvious example is the fact that there's debate about this, as inevitably there is among the people who study these things, but it is, I think there is something like a consensus that Irish monks in about the 7th century invented white space. So those, and I've marked the bits in the title, those bits of white space between the words, in a lot of, there were different ways of doing it, and not all Latin and Roman inscriptions, for instance, had sometimes dots between the words, but they very frequently did not use white space, and they had what was called scriptura continua. It just went on. It was written on. And that was partly, people have speculated, it was because of the fact that it was the people who were using that writing already memorized the text. So you did not need that kind of level of separation to know the text, as it were. The Irish monks were having to deal with the fact that native Latin speakers were no longer around and they had to teach the language. So they tried to make it to simplify it and separate out the words. Okay. The most famous bit of scriptura continua is going back to the Rosetta Stone. In all those different scripts, obviously hieroglyphics operating on a different norm. just a little statement about that. In all sorts of ways, scriptura continua is making a little comeback in certain ways for for us now. So that was the key thing I wanted to get to is, yes, we have all these examples, but actually the first thing we have to do, I think, and it's the conceptual issue and the policy issue, is to first begin with the ordinary things that are around us already, where there's an intercultural politics going on already. Thanks.
Okay, thanks so much for that. That was really thought-provoking, and I'm sure we're going to have a really great discussion. Elika has to leave in a minute, but I think is going to say a few words. I'm going to persuade her to say a few words before going. So, do you want to come up here? Okay. So, yes, so Elika is probably known to most of you. She's Professor of World Literature and English here and fellow at Walsall College. She published, huge numbers of books, really. Colonial and Postcolonial Literature is one of the best known. 1995 and 2005. I'll just select a few. Dalai Empire, the National and the Postcolonial, 1890 to 1920 in 2002. Nelson Mandela in 2008. She's also written 4 novels and has edited Robert Baden-Powell's Scouting for Boys, an anthology of empire writing, J.M. Coetzee's Writing and Theory. And Terror and the Postcolonial. Sorry, the list keeps going on and I don't really know where to stop. I thought that the kind of next project might be the kind of interesting one as well. She's at the moment working on a book on empires and networks and a new novel, Shouting in the Dark. So thanks, Elika, for staying on.
Okay, thanks, Jane. I should explain that I should have departed 10 minutes ago because it's my youngest son's 13th birthday, and I'm going to be dead, and intercultural relations are going to have broken down very, very seriously if I'm not there very, very shortly. So I'm going to cut down everything I was going to say to about 2 minutes. I had some remarks about what makes interculturality possible, but they do rather sort of replicate and go over the same ground as we've heard from Birgit and as we've heard from Peter. So I think it would be fine to cut through those. I then had some remarks about bilingualism and what it is to inhabit a condition of bilingualism, such as I do, but I know many others in the room do too, where you always have the sense of the word in the other language hovering behind the words that you were speaking, reading, or using, which is it's a fascinating condition, and it's one, I think, on which interculturality is predicated, or trilingualism too, for that matter. And it was, you know, wonderful to hear Birgit's kind of, you know, fluid movement between the different languages that she was citing and addressing in her talk. And also looking at the kind of the written renditions of different languages that Peter shared with us. So, going to the third section, just very, very briefly, the main observation I wanted to make, and it's a cultural historical observation. So I've kind of leapfrogged the theory and the reflections on bilingualism straight to the cultural history, which is kind of to be expected from someone coming from my position. And that was just to say that that interculturality does require a significant degree of cultural and linguistic convergence, whether in literature or in life. And if this seems something of a statement of the obvious, especially after the other two presentations, I just want to draw your attention to, and perhaps this is something you could filter into the discussion later, I'd like to draw your attention to an experience that was almost ubiquitous amongst early Indian travellers to Britain in the late 19th century, who form the subject of a book that I recently finished. They all, to quote Amitav Ghosh, and I think this is also formative for the experience of Mehrotra that Peter was referring us to, they all, to quote Amitav Ghosh, had been travelling in the West before they ever arrived in the West. What does this mean? Well, it's a question of, or a situation of colonial education, reading English books at colonial schools, colonial institutions in India as part of growing up, as part of their education. They therefore had certain strong images and expectations of the West, of London, of Paris, of Oxford, of Cambridge, of the Sorbonne, before they ever arrived in Europe. And I had a host of examples from the Parsi traveller Malabari, for example, from various Calcutta newspapers, citing journalism, journalists talking about, for example, the 1886 Indian and colonial exhibition that was held in London, writing about it from the vantage point of Calcutta without ever having travelled and seen the exhibition, you know, writing about it from a distance, an alienated position, to quote that word that you were using, Birgit. But writing about it nonetheless with incredible intimacy and closeness and interiority, because if you like, these cultural experiences had been disseminated from the European metropolis and were familiar, were intimate to these, if you like, colonial schoolboys. There are present-day examples of this too in the work of Salman Rushdie, famously of Timothy Moe, of Chinua Achebe, already mentioned, and I'm very grateful to Peter for the mention because he was an example that I was going to bring to you. But maybe I can end with this quote. Satadru Sen observes a Sri Kumar Ranjit Singhji, who in 1900 was the first Indian to play cricket for England, and as an English player he played against Australia for England. He studied at Cambridge. He was one of these colonial schoolboys that I've been referring to. And Sen writes of Ranjit Singhji, he went abroad before he ever embarked for England. And so it's that cultural convergence that is the main thing I want to put on the table. And I wish you all a very, very stimulating discussion.
Okay, thanks so much, Elika. And we'll try and keep those thoughts in mind. I think probably everyone's ready for a bit of a break.